call the Senate Tax Committee to order. Members, Senator Prettner-Solin's got a very small little bill, and she needs to get to committee, so we're going to move hear her bill first, and then we'll go to Senator Berglund's Senate File 3099. Senator Solin, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senate File 3390 is a bill which extends the time frame for two tax increment financing districts in the city of Duluth. Mr. Chair, I might mention that one of them is in your district and one of them is in my district. Business development efforts often take some time, particularly in districts that face challenges or are targeting a particular business sector. And one of the districts for which Duluth is seeking an extension is the old Garfield Railroad Yard in Duluth West End near the waterfront. Much of this property has needed extensive brownfield cleanup, but we do have prospective developments if we can use the increment from the district to make some infrastructure improvements. The second district is over the hill toward the airport. This district is focused on technology-based businesses that require high-speed internet and other utility access. Again, local development officials have been working with a business prospect to come into this district. In each case, the extension that Duluth is seeking for the district is from a 5-year limit to a 10-year limit. The legislature has considered and approved TIF district extensions on par with this on several occasions. And Mr. Chair, I do have a handout that shows the multiple extensions that have occurred extending the districts. And I have with me today Tom Cotruvo, who works on economic development matters for the city of Duluth, to tell you a bit more about this proposal to extend the time frame for these tax increment financing districts.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Tom Cotruvo. I'm the executive director of the Duluth Economic Development Authority. As Senator Prettner-Solin explained, this is not the creation of a new district. This is an extension of the 5-year rule for two districts that we have created in Duluth. One was created in the year 2000, one was created in 2001. So we would like to give ourselves another 5 years to complete the projects in these districts. Development in Duluth just doesn't happen at a fast enough pace to get all the work done within 5 years. And as Senator Prettner-Solin mentioned, 15 communities have received these types of extensions of their TIF districts in the past, and we would appreciate your consideration of this bill. I would like to point out that Duluth had created 24 tax increment districts. 8 of those have now been decertified, so 1/3 of them are now decertified. Our two largest districts, one was for the paper mill project. That was decertified in 2005, and that accounted for about 1/3 of our TIF. And in 2009, our downtown district will expire, which is about another 1/3 of our TIF. So we're using TIF less and less in the future and relying on other forms of assistance. But thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Cotruvo, has the city created any new TIF districts since TIF District 21?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes, we have. We've committed created 3 new districts since District 21.
And what years were they in?
I believe that those were in years 2007, 2006, and 2005.
Any others on the planning horizon?
Not to my knowledge.
I hear from county commissioners quite often that they'd appreciate if the city would not utilize it to the extent that they have in the past.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes, we have been working with the county. We understand their concerns. One of the methods of assistance that the county encourages us to use is abatement, tax abatement. And last year, in 2007, the city of Duluth created a tax abatement policy for economic development projects. And one of our projects was done through abatement rather than tax increment. So we are working with our county commissioners and listening to them to try to come up with methods of financial assistance for projects that are compatible with their goals. And I might add that the county also approved the abatement that we had approved in 2007, and that was for the Cirrus expansion, which has become a very significant economic engine in Duluth and for the county.
How's the new Cirrus expansion? I mean, have they made a decision to expand again? Is that publicly been made?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're very pleased that about 2 months ago we entered into a lease with Cirrus for the former Northwest Airlines maintenance facility. So we're now calling that Cirrus North. That building is 189,000 square feet. It's a very large building, and we expect a considerable amount of expansion to take place within that building. Cirrus's initial needs were for a 60,000 square foot research and development center. And once they saw the size of this building, now they're starting to make plans to increase their production of airplanes in the building. So we're hopeful that that building will see several levels of expansion by Cirrus. And in fact, we would also be able to accommodate expansion of that building in the future if they become even larger than what they are in the foreseeable future. But the Cirrus development, we're very pleased with that moving into the Northwest Airlines facility.
How many jobs have they committed, new jobs have they committed to create currently?
Their current expansion was a minimum of 200 new jobs.
Anything, members? Thank you for coming down, and thank you, Senator Pretner Solon. The chair lays over Senate File 3390 of his bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
No, I didn't. Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. Yeah.
Senator Berglund?
He's in form. You're a stickler.
She should be here soon, I hope.
So what's the amendment?
Well, I don't know, because when we left last night, we thought it was the third engrossment. So it's on the Berglund.
Berglund, welcome to the Tax Committee. We've got a pretty extensive list of people that have asked to testify. I'm hoping that they came to testify on the fee or tax provisions in the bill and not something else, but I guess we'll...
I don't know. We've only asked two people to come, so...
Okay. So anyway, those of you that are on the list to testify, the chair and the committee would appreciate if you could kind of keep your comments to the provisions that are in this committee is under our jurisdiction, and we think fees are a lot like taxes, so that's what we're here to talk about. Senator Berglund, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me begin by just saying that I am expecting a couple of amendments. I don't think they're quite here yet, but if you could let me know when they arrive. Mr. Chairman and members, this bill is the product of work that was done over the summer, fall, and winter by the Healthcare Access Commission and the Governor's Healthcare Transformation Task Force. And the first component that might be described as having a fee in it would be the Public Health Improvement section of the bill. It is Article 1. And the healthcare reform that we worked on had three parts to it. One part is improving public health, reducing smoking and obesity. And over the long haul, it will have a direct impact on reducing healthcare costs if we can be successful in this endeavor. Their second component is reducing the cost of healthcare for people who already have insurance. And the third, and that is done primarily through payment reform strategies. The third part is expanding access for the uninsured and underinsured. And so as we go through the bill, I'll be talking about one of those three parts of the bill. The first part, the public health part of the bill, is using the statewide health improvement program, which we've been piloting with federal dollars in four communities in Minnesota very successfully. This is a program that has accountability built into it. Communities are to design programs that will reduce obesity, smoking, and the second stage is inappropriate chemical abuse. There is accountability built into it, so the grants will not continue if the communities are not successful and have good outcomes. The program is funded through a public health improvement assessment. This is on not-for-profit hospitals and not-for-profit health plans And what it asks is that a small part of the money they're required to invest in their community in order to retain their not-for-profit status would go into a dedicated health improvement fund. The bill calls for $20 million the first year and $40 million the next 4 years. If our program is successful after that, we would anticipate being able to fund it out of savings offset that is in the bill later, and I'll explain that in a minute. So this is to get this program up and started.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, so on page 4, section 3, did you have a percent that it's a blank percent now? Did you? It's on page 4, line 15.
Well, as I said, I'm waiting for amendments. I hope it'll be in the amendment. Somebody was supposed to be calculating it so that we would come out with the right amount of dollars. We're keying this to a dollar amount.
Okay, we'll wait.
As I said, $20 million the first year and $40 million for the next 4 years. And we have two sources of funding for it, so trying to get the percentage right.
Thank you.
Senator Berglund, on page 2, the statewide health improvement program in the goals, I'm on line 2.7 to 2.14. I'm wondering on line 2.14, where we're trying to reduce the percentage of Minnesotans who are obese, overweight, use tobacco, illegal drugs, or alcohol, the grants are an eligible grant recipient would a use would be to reduce the use of illegal drugs, but up on line 2.9 we don't mention drugs. We just say the goal is to obesity, overweight, tobacco, and alcohol. We don't say drugs. Is there a reason for that?
Mr. Chairman, it's supposed to be misuse alcohol or illegal drugs in both places in the bill, so maybe later we can.
Okay, maybe orally we can.
Yes.
Okay.
So essentially what we're doing here is targeting funds that are being spent now in this statewide effort to help improve our public health. The next part of the bill that you would be interested in, I believe, has to do with the insurance exchange. The purpose of the insurance exchange is twofold. One, to make it easier for people to compare healthcare policies and to try to, you know, compare price and benefits, and to make it easier for people to sign up for a health insurance policy.
Senator Berglund, what page?
Page 28, Mr. Chair.
28? Okay.
I've just gotten the new engrossment this morning, so I don't have my pages marked. But
page 28, Senator Berglund.
We're working on the fourth engrossment.
Correct? Yes. The second purpose, and the one that you would be the most interested in, has to do with making it possible for individuals who do not have employer insurance offered to them to be able to get the benefit of a 125 tax, the 125 tax program, in order to offset some of the costs of their health insurance. The 125 plan, as you probably are aware, is a program that allows you to use pre-tax dollars for buying health care policies or for meeting health care obligations, co-pays, deductibles, health care savings accounts, etc. So what this provision does is it administers the 125 benefit for businesses of 50 or between 11 and 50 or smaller if they want to have it administered there. And it gives individuals the opportunity to have a more affordable insurance policy through the use of the 125 benefit. This will reduce the cost of insurance anywhere from 20 to 50%, depending on the cost of the policy you purchase and whatever your income is.
Can employers already do that? What's the reason?
They can, but if you don't offer insurance at all, you're not likely to be offering a 125 benefit. And we also know that there are many small employers that while they could offer it, they don't. And part of the reason we expect that is because of the difficulty of administering it. And so this will give them a place where it can be administered. It will give their employees portability of coverage. It will give their employees more choice of coverage.
Has revenue given us any numbers on what they expect that tax expenditure is going to cost?
Well, I will have an amendment to narrow the scope of the bill. We would be covering the uninsured with this tax benefit initially. That has always been the focus. If we have to choose, we choose the uninsured first. And because we are paying for this through the savings offset program that's in the bill later on, we don't want to be too aggressive in the cost of it in the beginning. So that cost would be around $4 million. It would come into play in the year 2010. If we get enough offset savings in the bill, then we would expect we would extend it to everyone who's in the program. And we expect at that time the cost would be around $60 million. Now, mind you that we
Senator Berglund, isn't the 125 plan, isn't that just a cost to the general fund, though?
We would be paying for it through the offset. The savings we get in the bill, we're paying for it through that mechanism. We need to remember that for every dollar we spend at the state level on this 125 benefit, we would be receiving $4 to $5 of federal benefit. So this is an important way that we help to raise the revenue needed to cover the uninsured in the bill. The second part of the bill requires, beginning in the year 2010, for all businesses of 11 to 50 to offer a 125 benefit in the state. The first year, there would be an informational program that would take place to inform employees of the benefit of having a 125 benefit available to them. And then that would happen in 2009 and 2010. Then businesses of 11 to 50 would be required to offer a 125 benefit. And that's why we don't have any tax impact until that year, because that's the year we expect we would have a lot more take up in the program.
What do you mean by businesses would be required to offer a 125?
Just exactly what I said, Mr. Chairman. What don't you understand about it?
Well,
they would
there's a cost to that to the employer.
Right, but because we are requiring it only for employees of 11 to 50. If at least three employees take the benefit, the costs then of the withholding to the employer are reduced, and the costs of setting up the 125 plan are offset.
So there would not be a cost to the employer?
It would be offset by reductions of other costs that they would have.
Yeah. Senator, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, so I'm gathering that any number of employees can access this 125. They don't have to be offered to all of the employees that the business has?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Skoy, it would be offered to all of the employees, But, of course, you're not using the benefit if you don't buy insurance. So if just three of the employees would be buying insurance, then their other withholding would be reduced because the income their income would be reduced for withholding purposes because they would have pre-tax dollars going for their health care.
Is anybody from revenue here? Revenue accounting, do we know what the tax expenditure is going to be or expect to be? Have we done that work yet? I mean, Senator Berglund, I think it's a good idea. I just want to make sure we count the money.
I agree with you, Mr. Chairman. We've had these discussions before.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Berglund, Paul Wilson from the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, we have looked at this. Just to reiterate a few things that Senator Berglund has said, the savings in response to Senator Scully's question, the savings the employer is in Social Security taxes withholding. So if employees use pre-tax accounts, those dollars are not subject to Social Security tax. So if it may take three, I think we said even two would do it. If two employees signed up, the savings the employer in the Social Security taxes they would have to pay, the employer share of it, would offset the cost to the employer of setting up the account by the best estimates we could get. On the larger question of the revenue impact, this is a change in the regulation of the insurance system. This is not a change in tax law, so that we have not prepared a revenue estimate for this bill in the normal sense. There are a lot of regulatory changes out there that occur. We do not have the expertise to in our division to make those kinds of estimates for all those bills. And so our general rule is we do not try to take into account the impact of regulatory changes unless there's a particular reason to do so and we can work with other people. We have worked with the Department of Health on this issue. Last year when the governor proposed something similar to this, there was a cost put on it in the governor's budget in work between the Department of Health and ourselves. As Senator Berglund has said, the best estimate out there is coming actually from a study that was mandated in last year's health bill. The Department of Health to do a study of the impact of the insurance exchange. An outside group, Mathematica Policy Research, has done that study, and their results, their estimate is about $4 million. In 2009, if everyone participates, and that's tax year 09, I would mention, though, that the bill actually gives a one-year delay. If employers can show that they have received information on the benefits of these programs, they don't have to sign up until 2010. So I don't think we would put a cost on it. I wouldn't think there'd be a cost for tax year 2009. So I think you're looking at about $2 million by their estimates for fiscal year 2010, and maybe a little over $4 million in 2011. Would be our best estimates. These numbers are somewhat preliminary because last night at 7:30 I got an email from Mathematica with a somewhat revised number from them. So they're still working on exactly. They did not model this particular option. And again, these numbers are for the bill as it will be amended by my understanding. So this is not for the bill as it's drafted, but for as it will be amended.
Mr. Wilson, thank you. Members, any questions of Mr. Wilson as long as he's at the table? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the amendments that I mentioned are here now.
Senator Berglund, we've got the A21 and 22. Which one would you like first?
Let's do the A21 first. This is an amendment that amends the section we were just talking about to exempt employers that offer group health insurance or are self-insured or have no employees who are eligible to participate in a 125 plan from being required to participate in the mandatory 125 offering.
So does subparagraph 2, is that the ERISA exemption, or what is that?
It allows employers to be self-insured, to go through TPA.
Assumption is there they have all their people already insured?
Well, the assumption is that they know about this benefit, and if they are choosing to offer it, fine. Usually it's not an employer of 50 or less that would be self-insured.
Mr. Chair, just as Senator Berglund said, this would basically limit the scope of, exempt the three classes of employers so that those who already offer health insurance, those who are self-insured, and employers that don't have eligible, this would not be included under the requirements of this plan.
Could be an employer whose employees are not eligible to participate in the Section 125.
Mr. Chair, I would assume it could be a variety of different individuals, perhaps employees that are, if they only have part-time employees or that have the insurance coverage, they may not. Perhaps Senator Berglund can address that.
Well, it would be pretty unusual, but it would be possible to have an employer who, you know, all the employees are covered through their spouse's insurance, and so they would not be eligible to receive a 125 benefit through that employer.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Berglund, what about the part-time employee that Susan mentioned?
We believe that part-time employees would be eligible to purchase insurance through the exchange, and oftentimes a part-time employee has several part-time jobs that add up to more than a full-time job. And that is one of the benefits of the exchange, is that they would be able to get this benefit and have insurance with a benefit that they otherwise wouldn't have.
Any questions on the 821 members? Senator Larson moves the A21 amendment. Favor signify by saying aye.
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 That is A21 is adopted. A22.
The A22 amendment is an amendment that deals with part of the bill we haven't discussed yet. In a minute we'll get to it. It deals with the savings offset assessment that's in the bill, and it changes the assessment for third-party administrators to be a fee placed on the third-party administrator for each insured resident in the state. This is how third-party administrators are, how they determine the fees for providing their administrative duties, and we believe that this would be a better way to assess this savings offset.
Senator Bergen, do we know what the percentage is?
It would vary. In the beginning, we expect the savings offset to be smaller and grow over time. And so the agreement that was made with the governor's office is that a third of the savings that are generated in the bill would be returned to the state to reinvest in insuring the uninsured and underinsured, investing in loan forgiveness programs for practitioners in underserved areas of the state, and investing in our higher education programs to create more primary care teaching slots, and the tax benefit that we have indicated would be provided through the 125 portion of the bill.
So, Senator Berglund, on line 62.24, the 4% is that intended to still remain in as a cap?
Yes.
I notice it's in We deleted it up above on line 21, but on line 24 it's still in.
Yes.
So it's intended to stay in as a cap?
Yes.
Questions, members? On the 822 amendment, Senator Larson moves to 822. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, all. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, then just one more thing about the insurance exchange before we move on, and that is that the insurance exchange has the power to make an assessment to cover their administrative costs. So the state would only be financing the costs of the exchange for startup purposes. After that, it would be a small assessment that would be placed on insurance policies to pay for those administrative costs. Mr. Chairman, then I think the next section that we would want to discuss is the section that deals with the savings offset. Before we talk about it, I think it would be important for me to talk just a little bit about the three stages of reform that we are doing in the bill to generate health care savings. First is to be more aggressive about what we're already doing in regard to quality. We know that in the state of Minnesota, we have been improving in terms of our outcomes for diabetes care. But even though we've been improving, we're only at 11% of the diabetics in Minnesota receiving the care they should receive. So we intend to continue on with trying to reward quality and doing it more aggressively by not just rewarding those who are the best at it, but rewarding those who improve at it. The next area is creating more medical homes. A medical home is a provider or group of providers who manages the chronic diseases of people that they have in their practice. Today, the more chronic diseases you have, the more doctors you are seeing. And the more doctors you are seeing, the more fragmented your care tends to be. So the idea of this is to pay for a medical home differently, to pay a care management fee to that provider, and to pay for nurse practitioners to be involved with that provider. We know from examples in Duluth and Minneapolis where providers are managing cardiac conditions by having nurse practitioners call the patients every day, having the patients weigh themselves at home every day, if necessary, providing oversized scales for people to weigh themselves on, and discussing what they have been eating, because what you eat doesn't just cause you to gain weight, it can cause you to retain water. And when you have a heart condition and you're retaining water, you're putting yourself at risk. What they've been able to do with this program is to save $1 million. No, to save millions of dollars, but to lose $1 million in reimbursement. Because if someone's heart condition gets worse and they go in the hospital, we automatically pay more than we would pay for anything else. But we don't pay for oversized scales. We don't pay for nurse practitioners to be on the phone every day with people. That would change with this medical home concept that's in the bill.
Senator Berglund, my insurance wouldn't pay for my blood pressure machine.
That would change under this bill.
I couldn't understand that. I think that was our state health plan, actually.
Well, that will change under this bill. The state health plan will be moving as one of the early entrants into this payment reform system. But that doesn't get us all the way there. And so the next part of the bill deals with payment reform that goes beyond the medical home. It would have providers setting their prices, and they would provide the same price to everyone. So instead of having an insurance company negotiating 500 in various insurance companies negotiating, you know, hundreds of rates with the same provider, there would be one rate for everybody. It would be transparent along with the quality that they provide, and you would be able to compare that price to other providers' prices. Providers would be tiered similarly to what they are in the state health plan, except that we would have everyone doing this, not just the state of Minnesota. So in getting this critical mass, providers would know that they will have a change in the way they are paid. Providers that are low cost and high quality would have options for how they were paid. They could be paid on baskets of care, they could be paid on a per person, per member, per month basis, or they could continue to be paid on a fee-for-service basis. That would be their choice. But they would set a price, and when this part of the payment reform is fully implemented, they would be accountable for their price for 1 year. Every year they can change their price if they want to, but they would be accountable for the price for 1 year so that you as a consumer would know that if you go to see them, the price that you see is the price you would be charged. We believe that in addition to the flexibility that this payment gives to providers to change the way they practice medicine, that there would be pressure on providers to get waste out of the system. And so if a simple x-ray might do the trick for you, you might not experience three MRIs that otherwise might be happening today. So that's the third level of payment reform. Then we have a mechanism in the bill for measuring where we're at with health care costs in 2008, having the health department project what the costs would be if we did nothing, and then measuring what the savings are over the next 5 to 6 years. And the difference would be the health care savings that we would be experiencing. A third of the health care savings then would be recaptured through a health care savings offset. The savings offset would be applied to everyone who purchases insurance, including third-party plans that are administered through third-party administrators. This would be deposited into a separate account. The reason for that is because we believe that we might need to be investing some more money into our Medicaid program. We have provisions in the bill to do outreach and to try and get more of our people that are covered, that are eligible to be covered today, enrolled in our programs. About 60% of the uninsured in our state are eligible for programs today, but either they don't know about them or it might be too hard for them to sign up. Whatever the reason, we're working on provisions in the bill to make sure that they would be able to get enrolled in a public program.
Mr. Chair.
So if that happens, then we would need to expand the funding that we have for our Medicaid program and other public programs. So the money would be deposited into a separate account.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Berglund, so there's you're going to project the savings, and then a third of the savings are going to go into this account. And how is that going to flow from that account to everyone? I think you said everyone will benefit.
Two-thirds of the savings would go to policy premium payers.
Reductions in premiums.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One-third would come back to an account in the state that would be appropriated from by the legislature.
For reducing or for increasing health care access for other people.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
All of the things I've been talking about.
Okay.
We consider this to be the dividend that the state would get for the work we're doing. And without making investments, the savings program doesn't really work. We have an affordability standard in the bill. It would allow us out of this fund to increase access to Minnesota care for everyone up to 300% of poverty. And through the exchange and other mechanisms, up to 400% of poverty. We believe even with the 125 benefit, older people, 55 and over, might have insurance premiums that would still be unaffordable for them. And so we could subsidize through the exchange for people up to 400% of poverty. It is a sliding scale that we have projected in the bill for affordability with at 300% of poverty, a 7% exit level, and at 400% of poverty, a 10% contribution exit level. And that is less than we have today in the Minnesota Care program. So we would be slightly reducing premiums in that program in the under this bill.
So, Senator Berglund, does the affordability standard apply to Minnesota Care and to the exchange participants?
It could, yes. In fact, it could in the future apply to people that have private insurance, but their private insurance costs them more than that, so that we could have ways to subsidize people who are purchasing through an employer, but their employer's insurance cost sharing is so great that they can't afford it.
But that's not in here.
That would be it's in here for planning purposes.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Berglund, could you give me a little remembrance of what the poverty level is? Are you using a federal standard of poverty? And what is a 300 and 400% figure?
Oh, I don't have that chart in front of me, but maybe somebody can get it and we can come back to your question.
Yeah,
in a few minutes.
Somebody from one of the departments here, tell us what that is. What's 300% of the poverty line for a family of four?
Otherwise, I have a chart up in my office somebody can run and get.
Maybe we can.
It does depend on family size.
Right. Maybe somebody can go get that so the committee can see what the affordability standard is in dollars.
It'd be about $27,000 for an individual at 300% of poverty.
For an individual?
Hmm?
For an individual.
For an individual.
And higher if it's other family members.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer, did that help?
Well, we're getting a little peephole idea of what it is, but we don't know what the real picture is. Most people, I would venture to guess, are families, and that there's a number of the bigger the family, the more that poverty level income bracket would grow. I don't know what it would be. You know, quite often the discussion is usually used around a standard of a family of four, and it would just be important to know for policy.
Mr. Chairman, we'll get the chart.
Okay, thank you.
And then we'll come back
sure.
to this question. But for your information, Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, Minnesota Care for Families goes up to 275% of poverty now. So it isn't a very big expansion for families over what it is today.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
Senator Berger, you said it would go to 300 and then you said that it might even go as high as 400. Is that a definite expansion up to 400, or are there conditions that would, could you maybe explain that a little bit more for me?
It's an affordability standard, Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer. So if you're at 400%, but your insurance is costing you more than 10% of your income, then the difference would be subsidized. We don't expect very many people will fall into that category. Mostly they will be older people between the ages of 55 and 65. Because we will still allow individual policies to be rated based on age, those premiums are higher, and we want to, and of course, that's an age group where you want to make sure people do have insurance coverage because they're more likely to have high blood pressure, more likely to have diabetes. So it would be a narrow group of people that would probably be affected, but it would be important to make sure that affordability is there.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Berglund, is there an interaction between this expanding the access to Minnesota Care and the governor's proposal to use the health care access fund to balance the budget? I mean, is that taking the money out of that fund that is supposed to be, for this Minnesota Care program going to have a negative impact on what you're attempting to do here?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Skoy, I don't support taking money out of the Minnesota Care fund to balance the budget. We were anticipating provisions in the bill that would go into effect sooner than 2010. That is when the affordability standard would go into effect. We were anticipating getting more people who are already eligible for programs enrolled in those programs and using the Minnesota Care money to be able to do that. That is part of the agreement that we have with the governor's office to continue expanding the number of uninsured through that mechanism.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Berglund, though, I think the Senator Skoy's part is that, does the governor's agreement to expand, is taking $250 million out of the fund to balance the budget kind of counterproductive if that's the agreement?
There was no agreement that he would not propose taking money out of the fund. But I told him we're not going to do it. So, you know, he can propose whatever he wants, and we'll pass a budget the way we want. And we sort of agreed that that was kind of how it would work. So,
but I think to Senator Skoy's part, is there enough money left in the fund that,
yes,
that this bill will work?
Yes.
If the governor were to prevail?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Limmer.
Senator Berglund, in the event that the funding does not come out of that larger fund, is the governor in agreement to get that money in a different direction? Did he reveal? Is there a global agreement of some sort where
Mr. Chairman,
whether or not the governor would agree with that? He doesn't keep me informed, but much less I don't think he keeps very many members of my caucus informed on what his options are on this particular bill.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, Senator Rosen's a co-author on this bill. She's not here right now because she has a bill up in education. She'll be here when she gets done, but we're working on this together. And the governor has agreed that we should be expanding the number of people who are eligible for our programs to be enrolled in our programs during 2009. And so we have provisions in the bill that would allow us to do that. We're not going to be able to do all the provisions in the bill. We're waiting to get fiscal notes on them.
Mr. Chair,
what page is it? I'm looking for it.
That may be a goal to achieve. The ultimate wish list is to expand numbers, but I guess I'm looking for the devil in the details of whether or not you and the governor have an agreement on how to finance it.
Yes.
And that's done.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, yes.
And how is it financed?
With the use of Minnesota Care.
Minnesota Care.
And when we get the savings offset, then the agreement is to use that fund.
We have a number in there?
To expand access to those who are eligible but unenrolled.
Is there a pretty good assurance that there would be a savings offset over time?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, yes, we believe that there will be. Even just the work we did last session in going to uniform billing, which is in the process of being implemented now, is expected to generate much? $60 to $70 million in savings for the system.
First year.
And we haven't, you know, that's already in the works. The other things in
43.
This bill, the healthcare transformation task force estimated by 2015 would be saving 20% of what we otherwise would have been spending. That was the charge given to them to try to achieve those savings by 2012. We couldn't get there by 2012, but we get there by 2015. It takes the healthcare system a little while to gear up to do the things that are in the bill. Mr. Chairman, I think then the only other thing that I can tell you is that that there is a goal in the bill. There is no mandate to purchase coverage in the bill, but there is a goal that we would achieve 97% of Minnesotans being covered by 2013. And if that doesn't happen, then the Department of Health would come back and make additional recommendations about things we could do to achieve that level of coverage.
So, Senator Berglund, are we essentially telling people they have to have health insurance?
We do a survey every 2 years to determine the level of uninsured, and that's any source of insurance.
So if we find somebody's not insured, are we going to send them a notice and tell them they have to have insurance, or how do we force compliance?
We aren't. We're not mandating that people have to have coverage. We believe most people in Minnesota want coverage. And the issue is making it affordable and easy to access, and that's what we're trying to do in the bill.
I'm just kind of wondering about that 22-year-old young guy who just graduated from college who thinks his body is still invincible. I was one of them once, and my back's hurting right now sitting here. I know it's not anymore, but when I was 22, I probably thought what could go wrong?
Well, Mr. Chairman, on a voluntary level, that's why we're not projecting 100%.
Is it kind of that group that we think?
That is one of the larger groups of uninsured in the state, those between 18 and 35. But we know that they have children. It's very important for their children to be covered because when children are not covered, they don't get their immunizations, they're not getting their well baby checkups, etc.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Berglund, I heard this bill in Commerce, and at that time there seemed to be a mandate on business to provide insurance for their employees by a certain date. Is that still in the bill, or can you explain that a little bit?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Johnson, I think you misunderstood the bill. It doesn't require employers to provide insurance. It requires them to sign up for a 125 benefit. That's a tax benefit. An individual can't get that benefit if their employer hasn't opted to provide it to them. We had testimony just a few minutes ago. The businesses that are included in that requirement in the year 2010 are businesses of 11 to 50. If just two employees sign up for health insurance, the cost of providing the 125 benefit is offset by the reduced withholding that employer would have, because the 125 benefit is giving the individual their insurance and health care costs on a pre-tax basis. So it reduces their income for withholding purposes. So that offsets whatever cost. The cost is very minimal for setting up a 125 benefit.
Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to your point about the number of Minnesotans that are going to be covered, I think that this requirement that the smaller business from 11 to 50 have the 125 plan will bring a lot of those people in. But I was wondering if Senator Berglund had a feel. So now we have the businesses that are from 0 to 11. Is that kind of going to be the next step in this, or what happens to those individuals?
That would be something we would be planning for in the future. Obviously, if we can get this piece done, then there are other ways that we could subsidize those employers, either through the exchange, through Minnesota Care. We would have a couple of options for helping them.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, so if you're a small business with three full-time employees but nine part-time employees, you would be in the category of 11 to 50 and have the availability of getting this 125 benefit if you have two or three of your employees signing up for health insurance.
Excuse me?
Senator Berglund, so if you're a small business with three full-time employees and nine or ten part-time employees, you're over that 11 threshold?
It'd be full-time equivalents.
Full-time equivalent. So you have to add up all your part-time employees and get to 11 that way. Okay.
And if not, those folks would still be eligible for Minnesota Care if their employer isn't offering them coverage. So we're not leaving them out in the cold, so to speak. The bill does intend to raise the income eligibility for Minnesota Care to make sure more people could get coverage through that option.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Berglund, do those small employers with less than 11 employees, do they have an opportunity to opt in if they'd like to?
Yes. They can opt in. We're just not going to try and mandate them because there's less chance that they'll have enough employees signing up to offset their cost.
Chairman, Senator Berglund, two quick questions. I think one of them answered. On page 54, health technology assessment is not a revenue item. That's an assessment of need. Okay. So that. And then how does money get into the health savings reinvestment fund on page 32? How does money get there? I've been looking for language for money into that fund.
Right. As I said earlier, the Department of Health would determine what the savings are, and then there would be an assessment on insurance companies, health plans, and third-party administrators. They would be the conduit for returning the savings to the state.
62. Page 62. Okay, and that is different than, on page public health improvement assessment. It's different than that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The public health improvement assessment is just dedicated for grants that would go back to our communities for improving public health. And that would start right away. The savings offset would be done. We expect the first year we would have any savings offset would be in 2010.
Senator Berglund, anything further?
Mr. Chairman, we do have a couple people to testify. Would like to take that now. I'd ask Brad Leto, the AFL-CIO.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, I'll make it fairly brief and just a couple of general comments and then on the cost, the issues that the committee is dealing with. First of all, the national AFL-CIO has a number of principles that they are looking for any health care proposal to meet, as well as we are involved with other unions and other organizations in the state that have a number of principles to meet. I know on the national, and I'm going to read them, and I can certainly hand them out later, but I think all but one, it meets completely, and the other one is partial. With other organizations in the state and other unions in the state, it meets most of the other principles we've talked about. We've been involved with health. I mean, we think, first of all, everybody should have access to affordable, quality health care. And getting to 97% understanding that there are always going to be some people and some of our probably union members that are those young folks that don't think they need health care until, as the chair mentioned, as Senator Berglund mentioned, they have children, in which case all of a sudden they realize we need health care. We've also done a lot of education with our members about the need for health care for everybody. Anyways, we believe the legislation in front of you does meet most of the principles that we've laid out. Obviously, we'd like to see everybody covered. Right now, we'd have liked to have seen everybody covered in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and this year. And in 2003, we actually, as folks probably know, we started pushing a constitutional amendment guaranteeing everybody to have health care. But as we said last year, and I testified in front of the Health Care Access Commission last year, as long as the we'd like to see progress in the legislature. We've seen last year and now this year good progress in the legislature to reform health care, and therefore are holding judgment and pushing back on that. And that was always the reason for it, was to try and encourage the legislature to act. On the fee, the various fee issues in the legislation, I was going through and looking at them before and then listening carefully, and nobody likes to pay fees, taxes, or anything else. The fact of the matter is, if you're going to provide health care, and I think this is a good mechanism that will get savings into the system as well, it's necessary. And I think that these are reasonable, it seems to me, or seems to us. The other thing I just want to mention is that, and I know this has nothing necessarily to do with the legislation, I think long term it might, and that's taking any money out of the Health Care Access Fund. Fees were paid into the Health Care Access Fund for health care, and I think they should remain there for health care, for expansion of health care into Minnesota Care and benefit expansions for Minnesota Care folks. I'd be happy to answer questions at all. Thank you.
Little, thank you very much. Senator Berglund, who else do you have?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to call on Tom Forsyth, Vice President of General Mills. Is he here? I know he's here. I just don't know if he's in the hall.
Mr. Forsyth here?
He was.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, while we're waiting, could I ask the author a question?
Certainly.
Senator Berglund, good morning. You may have addressed this already, but do the hospitals have a position about this bill? And in particular, I'm looking at Section 3 in Article 1 about the commissioner's assessment to each hospital on an annualized basis to contribute into the fund, the Health Improvement Fund. Do they have a position on that?
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Ortman, they haven't testified. I mean, I think, you know, probably many of them would just assume that they didn't have to contribute something, but they do have a requirement under state law that they have to invest in their community to meet their not-for-profit status. And under the bill, we would consider them having met their obligation with this assessment. Most institutions are investing way more than this, and we would expect them to continue to do that.
Senator Ortman, the Minnesota Hospital Association is on the list of testifiers if you look at the agenda. So
thank you.
I think we'll get that opportunity to ask that. Mr. Forsyth in the room? Oh, okay.
She's here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Forsyth. I'm from General Mills. There I am head of the corporate communications function, but I'm also the health policy guy, and I have been for about 17 years. I was a member of the Minnesota Healthcare Commission, also one of the five people around the table when we started the Buyers Healthcare Action Group. I do policy on healthcare at both the state and federal level, and I was also a member of the Governor's Transformation Task Force. I'd like to commend Senator Berglund for her leadership, not just in carrying this bill, but over a couple of decades on this topic, and I can tell you it's not easy because I've been working on it a long time, too. I will also say that I support most of this bill strongly. I could wax on about payment reform and delivery reform. That is what I think is the most important funding mechanism in this bill. I was asked in a House committee what I thought this would cost the state. I said, I think that the goal here is for this to cost the state less than we pay today. And I would like you to not lose sight of that funding mechanism because I think it's the key. I think it's the heart of the bill. I could go on at length about level 1, 2, and 3, but I would just very quickly say, I can tell you, I think this is going to work. In fact, I'm confident it can work. Level 3 has already worked for us when we were running exactly that same mechanism in BK. I could also go on about the benefits of the health care insurance exchange. I think that has very positive benefits for small employers particularly. I would like to just say that I think the important parts of the bill are payment reform, delivery reform. However, I also understand this is the tax committee, and the mechanisms that are in the bill, I will probably echo the comments of the Minnesota Business Partnership and the Minnesota Chamber when you hear them. Beyond that, I'd just like to say that this is an important effort, and we would like to see it move forward.
Questions, members? Mr. Forsyth, I think. Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Forsyth, you spoke of how this might work, but give me an idea. I don't know if you're making your comments as a member of some of these advisory boards, but you represent a large corporation. Is that corporation willing to pay the offset that's being talked about in this bill?
Well, I think the most, Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I think the most important comment there would be that self-insured employers want to have a mechanism that they will, in fact, pay. We feel very strongly about ERISA. I don't think there's any question about that. But I want to be clear that the mechanism that we do pay today is the provider tax. We're supportive of the provider tax. General Mills is paying the provider tax. I like the provider tax. I realize it's very unpopular. That's one of the things I like about it the most. So on the transformation task force, that's what I spoke in favor of because I think self-insured employers want a mechanism that they will participate in to advance health care reform because we feel very strongly about the reform aspects of this bill. We want to attack the problem of rising health care costs, and we want to participate.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
Definitively, General Mills is willing to pay the savings offset that's represented in this bill.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, I think what Mr. Forsyth has said is that they are willing to contribute a third of the savings that this program will generate back to the state. They believe that the provider tax would be a better mechanism to recapture those dollars. The agreement that we have with the governor is to use the savings offset mechanism that is in this bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I was trying to get some information from the representative of the corporation, and I didn't get an answer directly whether or not definitively General Mills is prepared to pay for this savings offset. You answered that question on behalf of Mr. Forsyth, and I was just trying to get a direct answer. And maybe Mr. Forsyth is not sure if he's prepared to make that answer or not.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, let me just say again, I think there's a better mechanism. That's not the mechanism in the bill. I'm not entirely sure about the mechanism in the bill. I think when you hear from the chamber and the partnership, you'll hear that we have concerns about that mechanism, particularly as to whether or not it incurs on ERISA. As a company that operates in 50 states and 100 countries, it would be difficult to us to operate without ERISA. So that part I'll be very frank on, and I won't surprise the senator when I say it, because I think I've always been extremely consistent on this point. However, there are mechanisms that will work, and we want to participate. I don't know if this mechanism would work. I don't know enough about Maine to be sure. I do have a mechanism that I think works better. and I realize it's unpopular. And because this is the Tax Committee, I would just say, you know, one of the things we think in terms of tax policy is a tax that is visible, that generates the revenue necessary, and that is kind of unpopular with the people who benefit from it and who collect it is not necessarily a bad tax. So I'm a provider tax fan, and I realize that isn't a very popular thing to say. But I know that ERISA companies are participating and are paying the provider tax, and that it does raise the money that we could use to do this. And I realize that is not part of the bill.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scott.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Forsyth, just so I clearly understand you, so what you would prefer is instead of using projected savings to fund this, you would prefer that we use the provider tax that we currently have in place for this health care expansion as opposed to, I'm not tracking that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scott, I would, but it would be an increase in the provider tax. I do believe there are some potentially creative mechanisms that could be used to encourage reform at the same time on payment and delivery. Perhaps level three, for example, those who are participating the most in payment reform and delivery reform might actually have an advantage provider tax. But the beauty of the provider tax, just to say it again, and I didn't come here to advocate for it, but if you scratch me, this is what comes out. This mechanism works, and we want to participate. We want it to be one that doesn't incur an ERISA challenge, and I realize that's not a popular position.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, what we're using in the bill is modeled after what is used in Maine. And they have had a number of lawsuits. None of them have been based on ERISA, but they've won all the lawsuits that they've had. So, yes, there's a small risk here that this would not be upheld, but this is what we've agreed to with the governor. I have always said that we could save enough money in the health care delivery system to provide affordable health care for everyone in Minnesota. And this bill is aimed at proving that right.
Members, I think we need to get on to some additional testimony. Mr. Forsyth, thank you very much coming in. Senator Berglund, do you have anybody else before we move to the list?
No, I have Scott Leitz from the Department of Health to help answer questions.
John from the Citizens Council on Healthcare, John Tyler and Twyla Brace.
She's going to tell them.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Tyler. I'm a board member of the Citizens Council on Healthcare. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before this committee. I am, by profession, a licensed insurance agent, and I know there are a number of licensed insurance agents in the room as well, and I specialize in the very marketplace that the Health Insurance Exchange is intended to address. I operate both in the individual environment as well as the small employer environment and have done so since 1981. The first comment I would like to make is regarding the mandate for the Section 125, and that is a section of the Internal Revenue Code that is universally available. In fact, it has been part of the Internal Revenue Code since 1954. But it is not universally applicable. One thing that is sometimes is missed is that there are discrimination testing. There is discrimination testing that is part of an employer's obligation. It's a tax-advantaged program. But a requirement of being part of this tax-advantaged program is that the highly compensated can't use too much of the program. If the highly compensated, if it's distorted and skewed in favor of the highly compensated, the employer is potentially susceptible to a payroll audit, and if found not to be in compliance, could be subject to back taxes and penalties, both to the individual as well as the employer as well. So the internal revenue, the IRC 125 is often offered and administered by many insurance companies for nothing. You know, Aflac, for example, offers it for nothing. They'll administer that for nothing, but it's still not universally applicable to every small employer. Even on the individual side, if the young immortals in a small employer choose not to participate with the program, even with the tax advantage, and it's largely the highly compensated in an employer that takes advantage of it, they're not in compliance, but it's mandated. So what do? You put the small employer potentially between a rock and a hard place as far as IRC 125 mandate. The other comment I would like to make, comments I have specifically from a tax standpoint with regard to the health insurance exchange. Now, I'd like to just draw an analogy from just a very short story with regard to a semi-truck that is stuck under a bridge. Can't get anywhere, forward or backward, just plain stuck. And officials are looking at the semi trying to figure out how to get it out of the bridge. And a bystander just makes the comment, well, why don't you let some air out of the tires? Okay, let air out of the tires, back the truck out, and so on. But I think what we're trying to accomplish here is kind of similar to the truck stuck under the bridge, because what we're trying to do here with regard to increased premium taxes to the employer, a half percent premium tax to the employer, for individuals and employers, which is, by the way, 27% of the marketplace, all we're really doing with that scenario as far as affordability is concerned is putting air in the tires. We're not taking air out of the tires. What small employers or individuals are asking for or looking for as far as reform is concerned is less taxation and less administration costs, not more. And I think having any kind of a $9 million annually to run the exchange, $20 million annually to run the Healthcare Transformation Commission created by the exchange, $40 million in additional taxes from hospitals and nonprofit companies to fund the public health improvement assessment created by the exchange is just putting more air in the tires. It's putting more financial responsibility to run yet another layer of bureaucracy that employers really do not believe is offering anything new. Insurance agents readily, as part of what we do, is we compare health plans for both individuals and small employers. That's what we do. We help them decide. We counsel them on which plan is best for them. People can complete applications online for health insurance, and do, with all the major carriers in the state of Minnesota. It is really straightforward as far as that process is concerned, but which one to buy isn't necessarily that straightforward. In a survey that you have in front of you, that's one of your handouts here, this is an employer survey that I'd like to just emphasize a couple of points specific to taxation here. And 80% of employers oppose making employers responsible to account for or forward mandatory universal health insurance premiums to a state insurance agency or to administer any kind of oversight process or whatever. Instead, more than 80% say their biggest problem is affordability of premiums. That is the issue with individuals and small employers. So I would really implore this committee not to continue the process of creating more mandates and more bureaucracies on top of what we already have without creating any value. Employers shop readily for health insurance. Employers may readily implement 125 plans for individual and group programs. Insurance agents are professionals to do that. There are ways of insuring more people, but it isn't in the system of putting more provider taxes in place. The $40 million hospital tax, my wife works for a major metro hospital in the administration department, and hospitals are straining to offer a competitive, safe product to their patients. It's putting on $40 million more in hospital taxes, if it doesn't get passed down to the premium payer or to the taxpayer, it has to, because hospitals just are not in a position of affording $40 million more in annual taxes to supplement healthcare transformation commission for the purposes of health improvement, and so on. So the answer truly is not to tax the sick more, and it's not to tax those that provide services more, and it's not to tax insurance premiums more. Please look in the other direction. Let's look for ways that to make premiums and policies more affordable, not less affordable, by reducing taxes. You'll get more people insured because the policies are more affordable. Allow for more creativity, if you will, in the marketplace by government being more creative. We really are in the technology of the 21st century as far as offering affordable health care right now through consumer-directed health plans. I would highly recommend that the state look to those types of plans because they are infinitely more efficient than 27% of administration fees going to government-covered or government-insured programs. It costs 27% just in administration fees to offer medical assistance, Minnesota Care, and general assistance medical care. That is not efficient. Those are the areas of inefficiencies that the taxpayer needs to have government look at, in my opinion, my professional opinion, to reduce costs to everybody so you don't have to tax the sick to make all these things happen. So thank you very much. That's my testimony.
Mr. Tyler, thank you. Ms. Brace?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council on Healthcare. And I'd just like to draw your attention, since this is the tax committee and you have looked at clearly the tax pieces of the bill. But I would like to just say, somewhat in line with what Mr. Tyler has just said, is the piece on public health is truly an additional tax. Because whoever is going to pay it, when it comes down to the bottom payer is the one who uses the hospital or buys the health insurance. So that $20 million or that $40 million is going to come out of the taxpayers, the patients, the insured enrollee's pocket. Secondly is the health insurance exchange. That's an assessment. The interesting thing about that assessment is that the board of directors or the board of governors of the exchange is allowed to make their own rules. There's no rulemaking requirements, so they don't ever have to come to the public and talk about this assessment that they're going to be making. We don't know what the assessment would be or how high it could go, but the fact of the matter is that no matter what it is, it will add to the cost of the health insurance premium. Now, consider the people who are not on 125 plans, and you heard Mr. Tyler talk about the risk of the 125 plan, and in the Commerce Committee, we had a lawyer who talked about the risk that employers face, and they have to carefully consider whether or not they should use the 125 plan because of what can happen if they do it wrong or they haven't thought of all the things that have to do with that plan, right? But the fact is that there are people who won't have the 125 plan. They won't have a tax-free exemption. And those will be individuals, but they will be paying the additional cost for the exchange unless they can find a plan outside the exchange. And the bill does not clearly say that there will be plans outside the exchange, that plans have to be offered outside the exchange, or that there will be any kind of affordable plan outside the exchange. So what we're talking here is the possibility of the individuals price to go up for their insurance premium. And the last thing is about the savings, this savings recapture, savings assessment, is, you know, I sort of listen to that, and I think the costs in this bill are sure. Very clearly we have costs, $20 million, $40 million, $9 million, $20 million, whatever. The costs are sure. But I think that the savings are on shifting sand. It's not very clear to me at all that we will be able to calibrate the savings, or that the savings that are calibrated are then that the money is going to go to whomever had the savings. I mean, it's sort of like, I feel like it's sort of like magical thinking that there's actually going to be savings here. And the health department gets to choose what they think the savings are. And to me, that's a little bit outside the rule of law, because how will we know that there have been savings? It will be just like statistics and calculations and data. And so what we can have is money being taken, and at the end of the day, the money that's taken for that savings assessment is going to be money again that is taken from our pockets. So I just think that there's a lot of hidden taxes with a lot of interesting terms in here, like fees and assessments, et cetera, but that they are all taxes, much like the health impact fee, which we all talked about, which we know is a tax. These are assessments. These are taxes as well. And so I asked you to consider this before we continue to move towards higher costs for the insured and higher costs for the patients. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Berglund, I expressed this concern in Commerce Committee, and I need to express it again. When you take away the oversight of the Department of Commerce or DHS on this and create your own governance board and rulemaking authority, I'm kind of afraid that you can create whatever you want to within this bill. I'd really like the oversight to come back in the purview of the commissioners instead of the governance board.
Mr. Chairman, first I'd just like to correct one thing that Ms. Brace said, and that is insurance policies will be able to be offered outside the exchange, and we expect the millions of policies that are out there today will still be offered. The ones in the exchange will be more narrow because we want people to be able to compare, and if you've got a million comparisons, you get lost in it. In regard to your question, Senator Johnson, the insurance exchange is a nonprofit organization in this bill, but the commissioners do serve on the board of directors.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Johnson.
Senator Berglund, I'd still like, since this is such a far-reaching policy, the legislature to have oversight.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there are there is a task force transformation commission that will be having oversight over all of the work that's going on with the exchange and the other parts of the bill, and they'll be in existence until 2012, and that has legislators on it. It has commissioners on it. In addition, there will be commissioners on the exchange.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ortman.
Just as a follow-up, Senator Berglund, if it becomes a bad policy, if it becomes a train wreck, I feel that we as a body should be able to annex it, get rid of it, repeal it. Mm-hmm. And with a task force as the governing board, I don't know that we would have that ability.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Johnson, one of the responsibilities of the commission is to report back to the legislature and to ask for mid-course corrections if they are needed in any part of the bill.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Mr. Tyler, could you address the assessment process for employers and the impact for that, the cost of those assessments? And in particular, I'm wondering, are the assessments paid based on the assessments of the entire group of employees? Does it include retirees or not include retirees? And then if you could talk about if it's paid on a per-person basis, what the impact is of that. What I'm getting at, and maybe you could address this in your comments, is there some incentive at the bottom, at the end of the road here, for an employer to hire somebody who's more healthy than someone who's not?
My understanding of the Mr. Chair,
Mr. Tyler.
Senator, my understanding of this is that it'd be a half a percent premium tax that would be allocated upon individual and group insurance premium, you know, policies to help finance the healthcare exchange. That would obviously be a direct tax that would be levied against directly against the roughly 27% of our population that uses fully insured, you know, policies. The rest are on government insured programs, or ERISA plans that are not paying into this. So that would be my understanding of that. With group insurance programs, just in general, the nature of their claim of their premium renewals is in part subject to their overall utilization of the health plans in general. It's called experience rating, and so table ratings are allowed for small employers that would range have premiums as widely separated as 66 2/3% between the best possible rates and the worst possible rates. So that type of scenario actually does exist in the marketplace, you know, right now. If an employer is actually aware of things. Now, there was really no real way of an employer knowing unless that information is either A, requested or demanded or volunteered as far as that's concerned. So that whole arrangement, the whole situation for as far as group insurance is concerned, makes it a little challenging. It can make it a little challenging as far as offering competitive plans and so on in the marketplace, which is an inherent issue with regard to any group plan, whether it's small, medium, or large, as far as that's concerned. Does that answer your question, Senator?
Thank you.
Great. Thank
you. Mr. Chair.
Ms. Brace.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I just wanted to say in response to what Senator Berglund has said, it is absolutely true that the bill says that individuals can buy health insurance outside of the exchange. We have at least two concerns. One is that that insurers will choose not to have dual tracks, the track inside the exchange and the track outside the exchange, one of them needing assessments, one of them not needing assessments. There's also no security that the plans outside the exchange will be plans that people want to buy. And once individuals get inside the exchange, they have to share probably a fair amount of data, which then becomes part of this governance board. This governance board is made of three commissioners, and it's made of eight people who are appointees. Now,
so is the commission is made of all appointees. All of these are appointees, and there's still no rulemaking authority. Rulemaking authority allows the public to comment on what comes out, for instance, on the exchange. We could comment and say we don't like that assessment or we don't like those rules or whatever, but without rulemaking, there's no ability to comment. There's no ability to have a hearing if you disagree. The commission just goes ahead as it will without the public being able to have any real input into it. And that's the commission doesn't have that. The advisory committees don't have that. The exchange doesn't have that. So essentially, in our opinion, it's really outside the rule of law. This thing can go on autonomously all by itself without any rulemaking authority.
Thank you very much. Senator Squay?
Well, Mr. Chair, I had a question for Senator Berglund on the next, while the next testifiers are coming up.
Go ahead. If they could have come up, Mary Krinke, and how about we get two at a time? Bill, is it Kalapopos from Association of Health Underwriters?
Mr. Chairman, while they're coming up, I do have the answer to Senator Limmer's question. So, for a family of four, 300% of poverty is $61,950. That would mean that at the 7% exit level, they'd be paying between $357 and $358 a month for their insurance out of their own pocket.
Senator Limmer, does that help?
Yeah.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Berglund, on page 49, line 4, is the Section 125 plan requirements, and it doesn't mention the FTE equivalent, and I don't know if there's somewhere else in the bill that defines current employees, but I know in our previous discussion you talked about that being 11 time equivalent.
Well, it's in here. We'll find it.
It is in there. Okay,
yeah.
That's what I wanted to make sure.
Ms. Krinke, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. Obviously, this is a large piece of legislation that impacts hospitals in many, many ways. My comments today are just focused on Article 1, Section 3, which is the issue of the new hospital tax. It is called a public health improvement assessment, but we in the hospital community do believe it is a new tax. If you look at traditionally what has been the definition of a tax versus what is the definition of a fee or an assessment, a tax is when an entity is not entering into activity voluntarily. A fee or an assessment means that the entity chooses to voluntarily pay an amount in return for receipt of a good or a service. So this is not, don't kid ourselves here, this is a new tax on hospitals and health plans to help pay for this new public health initiative. Now, I want to be clear that the Hospital Association supports this new public health initiative. We are not opposed to that element of the bill. We think that the funding source should be broad-based. And I know it's a very popular funding source right now, but clearly the Healthcare Access Fund is an appropriate funding source for this public health initiative. The original Transformation Task Force work group suggested a cigarette tax as the appropriate funding mechanism. We think that just choosing inpatient acute care services as the funding mechanism to pay for a public health initiative is not the appropriate funding mechanism. I'd like to add that this tax will be inflationary because the hospital community will be forced to pass this along to our private payers. It's also an unpredictable tax in that in its current form, it has a set amount that it hopes to raise, but it doesn't have a set percentage that it is charging. And this is very unusual in tax policy to just say we have a dollar threshold that we want to collect, but not a certain percentage that is being charged. So ironically, if hospital revenues go down, we would be paying a higher tax to generate this $40 million assessment. or tax. I would like to add one other comment, that in the Health Policy Committee, they did make three changes that did greatly improve this new tax for the hospital community. Number one, they excluded Medicare revenue. And I want to tell you, this is extremely important for the hospital community. Senior citizens are a large percentage of our business. Medicare underpays us the cost of our services. So we were very pleased that they excluded Medicare revenue from this new tax. Senator Berglund also offered a sunset date of 2013, which was also not originally included. This also was of benefit to us because we were very nervous that this tax may go on indefinitely. And the third thing that was added, and I hate to use this line, but misery loves company, they also included the health plans in this tax with the hospitals, and so the tax is spread a little more broadly, so it does not fall exclusively on the hospital community. I would like to just add, if this mechanism moves forward, the hospital community would very much like to also exclude Medicaid revenue from the tax. Currently, the state reimburses hospitals below the cost of providing Medicaid services, and likewise, we cannot pass that through to the payers. So any tax on Medicaid services would have to be borne by the hospital, and we wouldn't be able to pass that through. So if we're going to exclude one government payer, we would like to exclude two government payers. We do think that the tax should be from a broader funding source, like a cigarette tax or like the Health Care Access Fund. But I do want to say that we support the public health initiative. Thank you.
Ms. Krenke, if the legislature were to exclude Medicaid services, you have any idea, what percentage of the total is that? How would it affect the percentage?
Mr. Chairman, for hospitals, Medicare may represent as much as 50% of our patients and 10% for Medicaid, but that's not our revenues. That's our patient load. So I don't have the revenue numbers at the top of my head right now. I could get that, I'm sure, for
Senator
you.
Senator Berglund, do we have a discussion about Medicaid services?
Mr. Chairman, we anticipate that the percentage would be 0.27%, and that would include Medicaid but not Medicare. Obviously, if we want to exclude Medicaid, we'd have to increase the percentage on the remainder of the base.
Senator Marty, did the Health Committee have a discussion about whether Medicaid services should be subject to the assessment tax, surcharge, fee, whatever we're going to call it? I call it a tax, but.
Mr. Chairman, we spent a lot of time discussing the health plan's inclusion, whether we should be doing it for the hospitals at all, but we did not specifically get into medical assistance, Medicaid part of it. But the same arguments for Medicare would apply for Medicaid as well, in terms of reimbursement rates for hospitals and concerns about that. So.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Berger?
I am sympathetic to their argument. Because there are hospitals that have a larger percentage of their revenue coming from Medicare and Medicaid. Other hospitals have a smaller amount.
Are you sympathetic enough to help them with that today?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have objection to that as long as people understand we would increase the percentage, then it would be about 0.4.
Be fair. I'll move that.
Counsel, what kind of language would we need there to help? We want Ms. Krenke to leave today saying the tax committee made the bill better for hospitals. Maybe we can come back to that, Senator Bergen. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chairman,
we'll work on some language.
Just wanted to make one other comment, and that is that hospitals and not-for-profit health plans are required to reinvest in their community. Mm-hmm. We had a study done by the Department of Health about a year ago to see whether they were earning their not-for-profit status. Most hospitals were, but there are some who are not. And this bill would require them then to meet their obligation.
Which one?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Johnson.
Ms. Krenke, conversely, if Medicaid wasn't excluded, what would be the ramifications? Obviously, patient care would go up.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I mean, this would be an additional cost of providing health care services that would be included in what we charge the business community. I mean, it's not an enormous amount of money, but it is would be passed through.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, I do think we need to put this in perspective. There's about $400 million worth of charity care being provided in this state. So $40 million is not a huge amount. And the bill would allow an institution to substitute. They could discontinue some of the community investment they're doing today in favor of paying this assessment.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Squire.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, is there an estimate of a reduction in charity care if
we want to
reach the goals of percentages insured?
Medicaid services.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Skoy, yes, there is.
Is that part of the, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, is that part of the savings that are
yes.
funding this?
Yes, it is.
Ms. Krenke?
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, I do think it's very important for me to say that hospitals are very committed to their communities, and it is unlikely that we would cut back on our current levels of community benefit that we provide in our communities. Last year, hospitals made over $1.9 billion worth of investments in our communities, and with or without this new tax, I doubt that a hospital that has a community board of directors would all of a sudden decide, well, we're not going to be involved in providing vaccines in our community, or we're not going to be involved in medical research. It's just very unlikely that a hospital would change its commitments to its communities based on this new tax.
But, Mr. Chairman, they could. They could. There are some that have foundations. They could take this money out of their foundation.
Ms. Krenke, is your testimony concluded?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. A question, Senator Berglund. I understand that if you're trying to fund this program, that you would maybe go to the hospitals and ask them to help participate. But I think it's the purview of the tax committee to talk about the tax or, you know, you call it something else, the assessment. But when it comes to their payment, why does it have to be adjustable annually? It creates to the unpredictability. And I think that that's a burden on the hospitals not to know how much they're going to have to pay every year. And so I'm wondering, what is the justification for that? And is there some way that you can make it a fee that is more predictable on an annual basis, so it's a percentage or a fee? Or can it be adjusted in less frequent time frames so that maybe it's a four-year adjustment or a two-year adjustment? Why 1 year, and why does there have to be so much flexibility?
I'm going to ask Mr. Lights to come up to the table to help me answer that question. I know we're trying to limit it to $40 million, not raise more money than that. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Lights. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, Senator Berglund is correct. The target dollar amount was $40 million to be able to invest at a level in community health improvement that would achieve results, measurable results on lowering rates of obesity, smoking, illegal drug use, and alcohol use. So that was the logic behind having it set at an amount that would raise $40 million. I understand your question about the fact that would change over time. It's five years that the assessment, the contribution would be in place. That would change over time. I think it's important to remember that because healthcare costs tend to go up over time, the actual assessment amount percentage would tend to go down over time. So the initial amount would probably be the initial amount that's raising $40 million would probably decline actually over a period of years because the base would be growing over that time period.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Then could we put in some kind of a maximum to say we're only going to raise $40 million and the tax will be some portion of that on an annual basis, but it won't be more than that?
that it would if we put it at a maximum amount of what the initial percentage would be. That would be the most we'd ever actually need to assess on a percentage basis, because we'd have to calculate what that is, but I do just think it's a
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, I believe we could do that. We would have to calculate what that percentage is. I don't have that information right now, but I believe that that would be something that would be doable.
Mr. Chair, I think that would improve this bill so very much. It's the unpredictability of it that is very troubling to me.
Mr. Chairman, to answer Senator Skoy's earlier question, the limit on the number of employees is on 49.4, page 49.4.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, that's the line that I was reading. It says employees with 11 or more current employees. Does the definition by current employees mean 11 FTEs, or how does that define that as not part-time?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Skoy, that is usually how you figure what calculates one employee is based on the FTE.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Skoy also has an oral amendment to address the Medicaid services starting on page 4, line 15.
Mr. Chair, on page 4, line 15, after Medicare, insert and Medicaid revenues and delete revenue. Page 4, delete revenue and insert and Medicaid revenues. And then on page 5, on line 24, after program, insert the following. Revenues received from the Department of Health and Human Services for state health care programs. And we'll delete lines 27 through 33.
I think it would be just human services.
That's correct. Human so it should be department. The Department of Human Services.
Well, Ms. Chair, I would move that. It seems to me that if Medicare is exempt, Medicaid should also be exempt.
Senator Berglund to the oral amendment of Senator Skoy's.
I think it's okay if it's not. If there's technical fix-up, we'll work on it.
On the Skoy oral amendment. Questions, members? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. The oral amendment prevails. It's incorporated into it.
Are we ready to go?
Yes.
I'm actually not Bill Kalopoulos. But thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, Senator Berglund, for having me here today. My name is Clark Fisher with the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, past president, current member of the Ledge Committee. I want to commend Senator Berglund first for some of the good initiatives that we see in this bill. There are wellness initiatives, managed care initiatives, dealing with tobacco are some of the very good things. But there are a couple of things that we still oppose in this bill. And we see it as a potential tax, actually probably will be a tax, on the taxpayers of Minnesota, private insurance in Minnesota. I'd like to reiterate some of the things that Mr. Tyler already said so eloquently. The exchange, what we don't see is a definitive cost for this exchange going forward. We had heard in previous testimony in another committee that about $9 million might be needed to get this thing up and running. But for the ongoing operation, there is no definite cost or set point for that. IT and media expenses alone are going to be a great cost to this program. And then we see that it's going to be thrown upon the tax or upon small group insurance and individual insurance to be able to fund this as we go forward. Under powers of the exchange, it gives the board the ability to establish fees on health plan premiums and small employer plans, as I mentioned just earlier. There's no cap on those fees. We find that to be somewhat dangerous, and there's no formula for these assessments as well. This is a new tax on small group insurance and individual insurance that doesn't currently exist. How is this in line with keeping health care costs down? Section 125 has already been covered. We do oppose that as well. We see that as being potential tax nightmare problems from a finding standpoint. Getting down to public health improvement assessment, we do disagree with this as well. I've been on the phone with the director of the Maine Association of Health Plans, and they are still in a lot of trouble out there trying to figure out what is happening with going to the governor, going to the government and saying, how can you come up with these numbers? The governor has promised them that he will come up with some better option in the future. I would not agree with going down that road. If you're going to bill insurance companies on assumed health care savings, you're going to have issues. They're going to come back and say, where did those numbers come from? And I fear that's going to be a fight that will go on into eternity. Also, it's going to ultimately shift that cost back onto the private insurance payer. So, again, the private insurance market is picking up the pieces to fund government-run plans, and we can't disagree with that. That's all I had to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. Next, we have Beth Hartwig. Let's have Aaron Sexton come up at the same time, and Jason Flores.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Hartwig, and I represent the Minnesota Business Partnership. I want to state out front that we are supportive of the reforms contained in this bill. However, I would like to address the savings recapture assessment, about which you've had many discussions here already today. This provision was modeled from the state of Maine's plan DERIGO. DERIGO is not yet fully implemented, and they are struggling with their savings offset payment funding mechanism. As the last testifier just mentioned, they are looking for alternatives there. In Governor Baldacci's State of the State earlier this year, he said, quote, "And I will work with the legislature to find a new way to fund DERIGO that is less contentious and more sustainable," end quote. Why would we set Minnesota down this same contentious and unsustainable path? This assessment is a tax on health care savings. It will add to the cost of insurance for everyone in the private sector. It just doesn't make sense. The more money saved, the more money the state will take. That's a perverse incentive for the market to strive for continued savings. But that's not it. It could be that health care expenses go up and the state still takes more money. Let me give you an example. Company A self-funds. They're fully responsible for all the claims paid. There is no insurance to offset the risk. Company A has a bad claims year. An employee with cancer, a couple diagnosed with diabetes, a premature baby. Their health care costs go up. They're higher than they expected. But at the same time, costs in the state overall go down, meaning there's an overall state savings, which will kick in the savings tax. So even though Company A's costs have gone up, they will be assessed up to 4% on the claims paid for that year, adding even more to their escalating health care costs. And also, as has been discussed, we believe that ERISA preempts the state regulation of self-funded organizations and that ERISA does preempt the provision in this bill. And there will very likely be a court challenge based on an ERISA preemption. When the courts uphold ERISA's preemption, this assessment will fall to the fully insured market alone, continuing a pattern of cost shifting in healthcare. I just had a chance to look at the A22 amendment that was put on, and I do still believe that my member companies would challenge this on an ERISA preemption. But let's say that it does preempt ERISA, and they could put this on. What is to prevent employers from using a third-party administrator from out of state, which is what happened in Maine? Really? Not only will the state lose the intended revenue, but there is a possibility of job loss as well for the people who would be otherwise paying those claims. But again, let me make it clear. While we oppose the saving recapture assessment, we do support the reform proposals and that will bring us to a more competitive, better functioning marketplace that will reduce the cost of health care for everyone. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The testifier brings up an interesting point. Conversely, the loss of jobs. What if in an interview an employer finds out that an employee, potential employee, has a pre-existing condition that would greatly impact their plan? I know we don't outright ask for that in interviews, but it could become part of the questioning, and that there could be potential non-hirings and job loss too.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, if an employer is going to discriminate based on the health condition of a potential employee, they're going to do it today. The health care costs are what are driving decisions in the system. This bill is intended to bring down health care costs. In regard to the issue of an organization choosing an out-of-state TPA, all TPAs that provide services to 10 or more employees for a business in the state of Minnesota are required to be registered with and licensed by the Department of Commerce. And we expect that this provision would apply to all TPAs that are registered with the Department of Commerce.
Sixthly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Erin Sexton. I'm the Director of Healthcare Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We, too, are pleased with many of the reforms in this bill, and we do think they will take significant steps toward reducing the cost of health care. At least we are hopeful of that, because that is one of the biggest concerns for our members. I feel like you're getting a lot of howevers, and I'm going to add a few more. However, we do oppose a few provisions in this bill. We are generally supportive of the concept of the health insurance exchange. We believe that the proposed health insurance exchange will provide a mechanism for employers to help their employees obtain coverage in the private market by allowing them to purchase individual health insurance using pre-tax dollars. Saying that, we oppose mandating employers to establish Section 125 plans, which is in Article 4, Section 15. If the health insurance exchange does provide the benefits that many hope it will, employers will establish Section 125s voluntarily. There are administrative costs for establishing and ongoing administration of these plans, and each employer should be able to make the decision on what makes most sense for their company and their employees. In addition, the exchange does have the power to assess fees on premiums of small employers and individual plans, which will again add to the cost of premiums instead of our goal of reducing those costs. We are also opposed to the health savings reinvestment assessment. This essentially equates to a premium tax on those who are purchasing health insurance in the private market. And coupled with the assessment allowed to fund the health insurance exchange, this bill will be adding additional taxes or fees on top of the many that we already have. If challenged under ERISA, this has a potential to fall solely on the fully insured market, which is made up of mainly small and medium-sized businesses, which cannot sustain this type of assessment. And I'll give another example, similar to Ms. Hartwig's, but this is a small employer. A small employer with 20 employees has a year where they have one maternity case and a cancer case. Their insurance premiums will go up regardless of how much savings there are in the overall system. They will experience a premium increase. In addition, they will now have this health savings reinvestment assessment and an additional assessment to run the health insurance exchange. All of these assessments could add up potentially to over 10%. And that's a significant hike. So addressing the health care costs is a priority for our members. And although there are many good pieces in this bill, we are hopeful that we will accomplish a reduction in health care costs. We do not believe that adding additional premium assessments will help this. Thank you for your time.
And, Mr. Chairman, I would just say this. If this would be preempted by ERISA, this savings offset, that would definitely need a mid-course correction, because we do not intend to move forward with this without getting a savings offset.
Right. Thank you. John Flores.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jason Flores. I'm Director of Government Affairs for the Twin West Chamber of Commerce. Twin West Chamber is a regional chamber of commerce based in the west and northwest suburbs. We have 1,000 member businesses in a base of 10 cities. And I'd just like to state, really, for my comments this morning for this conversation, fully 85% of our members are small businesses under 20 employees. So very much the concerns of small businesses are the concerns of the Twin West Chamber. While this bill does take significant steps toward our key goals of increased transparency, payment reform, utilization of health information technology, and promoting wellness, I do have several concerns which have already been expressed. I'll just quickly echo those. First, our concern that even after the amendment, the mandate to create the Section 125 plans for small businesses is still in effect in after the amendment. While this is a tool that has been used, it does have benefits and for some people may be appropriate. It does not apply to all cases, and as Ms. Sexton mentioned, it should be a decision of an employer whether or not to implement one of those plans. Second, we are also opposed to the health savings reinvestment assessment, which does essentially create another premium tax. Echoing concerns already expressed here this morning, we would prefer a more broad-based mechanism that affects all employers equally. The fully insured market, made up mainly of small and medium-sized employers and individuals, already pays many health care taxes and assessments. The MSHA assessment, premium tax, provider tax, MA surcharge, with all of those and then the new ones proposed in this bill, our small businesses would face up to 10.5% increase in taxes simply on top of their premiums, which are already difficult for them to afford and difficult for our small businesses especially to continue to provide health care for their employees. So with those concerns, thank you for the opportunity to testify here today.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Julie Bruner. I'm representing the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I want to thank Senator Berglund and Senator Rosen for their work over the past year to move forward on health care reform. This is a complicated and important topic, and their leadership is contributing to a really robust discussion this year. We agree that everyone should have access to affordable health care. We're pleased with many of the ideas that are included in this bill. We fully support the proposals to expand and increase coverage through increased eligibility. We support the efforts to improve public health. The problem we see with the public health proposal has been well expressed by Ms. Krinke in her testimony, and that is that it relies on funding from the hospitals and health plans to pay the costs of the initiative. Public health is a basic public service that citizens rely on and which deserves a broad, stable, and ongoing funding source. Another provision in the bill that has created great concern, and you've heard about it today, is the savings offset assessment. The savings offset assessment is, in reality, a tax on health care premiums. This tax will increase the cost of premiums for small businesses and individuals. We do not believe that this tax can be passed through to the self-funded or third-party administrators, and we do expect that there would be a ERISA challenge that would be upheld by the courts. The savings offset then can only apply to the fully insured market, which now constitutes only 27% of the insurance market in Minnesota. The new tax on small employers and individuals isn't a fair way to fund these goals. A review of this assessment in Maine suggests it has many problems and has not had the impact of expanding coverage in the way that it was originally designed. We would urge you to consider other funding mechanisms to support the goals of the bill. We're also concerned about the provisions in the bill related to the insurance exchange. In particular, you've heard a great deal of discussion about the Section 125 plans. We're concerned about the provision that would permit application to the 125 plans during open enrollment. While we continue to gather data on the extent of the adverse selection that this would cause in the individual market, we are concerned that it will have more than a marginal impact. We have some broader concerns about funding of the exchange and the overall value of the exchange and what it brings to the citizens of Minnesota. It's not clear what problems the exchange will actually fix, but the exchange appears to create a new bureaucracy that has limited value. We support many parts of Senator Berglund's bill, and we want to work with her to see the goals of the bill realized in health reform in Minnesota. Thank you.
Mr. Bruner, thank you. Next, Department of Health, Scott Leitz, anything? No. We have, members, we have two people that aren't on your list that asked to testify this morning. Stephen Schumacki and, Glenn Grunhagen?
That's close enough.
Is that close? Grunhagen, I think that's got to be pretty close. Am I close?
I answered anything close, yes. No, that's pretty correct, Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
What, I go first?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, it's Steve Schumacher, by the way. It's close enough, though.
Odd. What, with the C-I or the I?
Yeah, they messed it up. It's Italian. They can't help it. They couldn't pronounce it.
So the I doesn't count.
No, it's
why don't you take it off?
I don't know. He got off the boat back in the 20s, and they just didn't know what to do.
So, Mr. Chair, I move that. We delete. No. Oh, sorry.
Thank you.
Hey, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you very much, Chairman and committee. I'm from my name is Steve Schumacher. I'm out of Hutchinson, Minnesota, and I represent a small insurance agency that this entire bill was brought to my attention about 2 months ago, and I was just totally caught off guard by it. And actually, at 10 o'clock last night, my office manager said, if you want to say something, you better go now because I don't want to hear about it the rest of our lives. So she kind of forced me, and I'm kind of a little unprepared, but I do have a few things I want to share. One of my concerns here mainly is the uncertainties. I see many. I'm very concerned about when I look at what you're putting to the table and eliminating the health exchange, I'm very concerned about losing the human element. The human element is critical. I've been doing insurance for 27 years, and I've learned over the years that people buy from people. They want to know what the best options are. They don't want to go to the computer. And I experienced this especially with Medicare D. What we found was people still want to feel that there's somebody there to help them. We did that work for pretty much free. We had real strong regulations. We couldn't talk to them about anything else but the Medicare D. And it kind of handcuffed us on what we could talk to them about. Like I said, you left your books in the car and you came in and talked to these seniors. You did it because you were given this great opportunity to help people. And I believe in giving back. And that was a good example. We did close to 300 of those Medicare D. And it reminds me of what we're asked to do here with this health exchange. I'm concerned that we are not going to be able to give the options to the clients. And when I say options, in fact, this evening I have a meeting with a group that I've insured for over 20 years. And last year, the renewal came in on this small group of about 28 employees, and the rates went up quite a bit. Well, Blue Cross Blue Shield offered a dual-choice plan, and what the dual-choice allowed people to do is go within their existing plan, no underwriting, make changes, and people that could benefit by a higher deductible who never used the plan actually enjoyed the advantage of the health savings account. Health savings account gives the tax incentives. It puts control of the cost back into their pocket, which I think is critical. And what I found unfortunate was the people that were sick and were using the plans quite a bit stayed on their traditional plans because of the first dollar drug coverage, the needed everything with a copay. And that's what's caused our problem. Well, now tonight, we have two meetings this week, and we're going to try to convince more of the employees to get positioned for August when the renewal comes up to go to the health savings account. Because with the savings, the employer was able to give back some of that savings to the employees. If they would participate, he would. And you're seeing the small businessman stepping up to the plate and making decisions for themselves. They don't want somebody telling them how to do it. They don't want to have dictation to tell them how to run their plan. And I tell you firsthand, I have a child that has a chronic illness, and I have an HSA account, and I maximize my HSA. If some people are aware how they work, I take advantage of the full tax incentive. I stuff it to the maximum, and my son takes care of his needs with our money. Well, we had a rate increase this year, and he said to me, Dad, you know, we used our plan a lot. And I said, well, we didn't use our plan until about November. And he goes, well, I used it all year. I said, that was our money. I said, Uncle Sam gave us the advantage of putting money in pre-tax, and we took it back out. This is where we're learning. And here's my son who lived with me my whole life. He would think he'd understand insurance. And I said, that is our dollars being used. We think twice before we spend our own money. And I'd rather have control of my own money, putting it into my own plan, take the high deductible, take care of myself, and live a healthy lifestyle, and have my money for the future. Now, I'd like to see my HSA grow, but now that my son can stay in there until 25, and I appreciate that new law, that's a good deal. He has to stay with me, and we're going to have to run with that high deductible until he's ineligible. But I'm not complaining. But my real concern is we're losing the whole idea is people having their own choice. And maybe I'm misunderstanding the exchange, but I see the exchange as a serious threat. I get a client who calls me up. I get a lot of calls because we spend money advertising. We're in a local business where people know us. And I give them direction. I give them choices in a plan. And I feel that that is something that you give up when you go into, and you're also going to get a lot of people that have illnesses are not going to really have go to the right plan. And I know, for example, which carriers underwrite better. I know exactly how it works. And I've been at it long enough to know, but I'm always willing to learn more. But what my biggest concern is we see people making choices, and these choices are going to be taken away from them. Right now, they're enjoying these choices. I had one example I want to bring up, and it'll be the last one. I had a family that was on Minnesota Care. He's a good businessman. I was kind of surprised that his income is where it needed to be to get it, but I'm not asking any questions. Well, his income went up, and he lost the eligibility. But his child was able to stay on. But the premium for the child was over $400 a month. But it left mom and dad without any coverage. And what you need to do is be creative. What I did, I set up a high HSA account, convinced him on how much he would take a high deductible, which was about $5,000, and position money into a side account, which would be HSA. In a matter of 6 months, he calls me up, and my nickname is Scooch, by the way. He says, Scooch, he says, this is the best thing I could have did. And I said, I could have told you a long time ago. You're getting the Minnesota Care, it sounds wonderful, but the money you're spending there, because your income's too high, you need to be in the private sector. And he's enjoying the savings. So I just hope that maybe the spirit of this bill doesn't lose the creativeness that us agents bring to the table. And that's all I really have to say. And I appreciate it.
Senator Berger.
Mr. Chairman, this bill would allow an agent to sell a policy through the exchange, and if they did so, they would be paid a commission on it. And, of course, we've limited the bill now with the amendments so that only employers that are not offering insurance have to offer the 125 plan. And it would be very unlikely, in my opinion, that an employer that doesn't offer insurance at all is going to offer a 125 plan. So this is going to open up a whole new group of people who will have the potential to have affordable insurance in the individual market through the 125 benefit, and they all will be available to the insurance agents of the state of Minnesota to market to.
Can I add sure, something to that? We right now work for, well, I'm not going to say this, we work for pretty low commission right now. We're probably the best, your best workforce is us. Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Medica, and all the carriers limit us quite substantially on what we get compensated. But I look at the ancillary business because I like to stay in front of my people. So I think the bottom line is I'm not exactly sure what the compensation is going to be through the exchange. But right now we're working for a very low amount now. But I'm glad to have a job and I enjoy what I do. But I hope that isn't so low that it's almost a waste of our time.
Mr. Chairman, it would be whatever commission would normally be paid by that policy if it were purchased in the private market.
Mr. Grunhagen.
Chairman Bach, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify here this morning. My name's Glenn Grunhagen. I have sold health insurance in the state of Minnesota for over 30 years. I have just under 100 clients in my small, or 1,000 clients in my small little agency out in Glencoe, Minnesota, which is real close to Hutchison. First thing I'd like to say is that I'm going to keep my comments brief. In addition, I respect Senator Berglund. Okay, I know she's well-intended. And I think we're all here because we care about having affordable health insurance for the citizens and children of the state of Minnesota. However, I strongly disagree with the philosophy that she's promoting in this bill. Just one quick comment. On Section 125, my understanding is the FICA tax is reduced. But, you know, everything kind of goes according to that law of unintended consequences. As you reduce FICA, as a person pays in less FICA or Social Security, their Social Security benefit goes down when they retire. So they're supposed to take that savings in FICA tax and put it into the and invest it for their retirement. So I think that's one thing that has not come up in the discussion yet. Okay, I oppose the health insurance exchange, also the rulemaking and the health insurance commissioner board, and the increase of any taxes or fees. I think there are some good things in the bill, but overall, I think the bill needs to be scratched and to be start over. I believe it's another step. I believe the health insurance exchange is another step in the wrong direction that will result in less medical care and higher costs for the citizens of the state of Minnesota, and it will eventually lead to rationing and a government-run health system, which will be expensive and inefficient. In addition, I think it will hurt small business and provide an even more incentive for business to leave the state or expand out of the state. In October 07 in the Minneapolis Tribune, there was an article about 3M where they could expand, where they're considering expanding outside the state of Minnesota, and they could save $1 billion a year in operating costs. I have a copy of the article with me if you'd like to see it. So more taxes and more government is only going to create more of a problem down the road. Okay, next, the least that should be done before you pass any bill is to have a group of experts assess government's impact on health care, cost, access, and treatment. In other words, has government's growing involvement in the health care industry had a positive impact? From my perspective, as an insurance agent over the last 30 years, the more government, the higher the cost, and the more we damage the doctor-patient relationship. So I think you should have clear facts and assessment on that before passing any type of bill. I will be the first to admit that the current situation in healthcare and the rising insurance premiums and healthcare costs is unacceptable and needs reform. The question is, which way do we go to improve the doctor-patient relationship? More government or free market competition? I have 7 brief recommendations in order to improve the health care in the state of Minnesota. Number one, open the state of Minnesota to outside health insurance competitors and also make health insurance portable. Today we have a limited amount of companies offering health insurance that I believe is to the detriment of the citizens of the state of Minnesota. Number two, repeal as many mandates as possible. This will bring down the cost of health care. Number three, guarantee issue will drive up the cost of health insurance in the state of Minnesota. Don't penalize the majority for the benefit of the minority. Come up with alternative ways of solving the problem. Number four, develop a legislative plan 3 to 5 years to get the state government out of paying for health care services. The government should be a referee, not a payer of health care services. Number five, empower people below the poverty line to purchase private health insurance, not Minnesota Care. Number six, tort and litigation reform. Number seven, do not limit new technologies. Technologies generally in our society and culture and economy bring the cost of things down and make things run better and more efficient. And yet I see government many times wanting to limit new technologies. I have a medical device engineer from St. Jude Medical that works here in the state of Minnesota. He and I are writing a short booklet about health insurance and new medical technologies. I have a copy of one of the chapters along. Anyway, finally, if you want to reduce health care costs, I would just point you towards the nursing home situation. You have a partnership law that you passed last year to help purchase long-term care policies. I think it's a good law, but you should amend the law in one way, that if a person is certified to go into a nursing home, if they have a family member that would take care of them at home, that the long-term care insurance policy could pay half the room rate benefit to the family member at home to take care of the nursing home person, rather than force all nursing home people under the partnership law into a nursing home, which is expensive. Most of those people don't want to be there. And by allowing a family member to participate in the care, you'd save money. You'd be empowering the family to solve its own problems. Okay? And I just want to make comment on the word voluntary. To use the word voluntary and government in the same sentence is an oxymoron. You're better off using the word voluntary mandate, okay? I'm a school board member for the last 13 years. You know, the government controls the playing field. You start this insurance exchange, you're going to eventually you'll discriminate against private companies and force everybody into the exchange. That's what's going to happen because the government makes the rules, and unfortunately, they never create an equal playing field. Last analogy, if I may, and then I'm done, is here's what I'm trying to get across. I run a small insurance agency, like I said. I've got under 1,000 clients, but I work 5 days a week. I go in Saturday morning. I work nights. I have 2 part-time secretaries, my wife, who reluctantly works for me at times, and I got an associate, all right? We service those 1,000 clients. I could give you examples of getting calls late at night, running out to people early in the morning to help them. If the government took over my agency tomorrow, within 1 year, they'd have 25 to 30 employees in there. Every year, those employees would want a raise, which I don't blame them, and they'd want more and more benefits, and they'd want to retire early. That's the problem with creating more and more government. And the number one employer in the state of Minnesota is the state of Minnesota. The number two is the federal government. And those of us who don't work for the government have to run 180 miles an hour to pay for all that nonsense. I mean government. Once in a while I get the word nonsense and government mixed up. So more government isn't going to make things better. It's going to make things worse and damage the doctor-patient relationship. I'm sorry if I'm a little passionate, but... anyway,
Mr. Gruenhagen, how's the school in Glencoe doing?
Hey, I'm glad you brought that up. And here's why. We were in SOD up to $775,000. We tried passing referendums and other things that failed, but the public said you need to cut before we help you out. So we went through a series of reductions, some of them painful, I'll be the first to admit, but necessary. Out of those reductions, we saved over $1 million, and we then ran a excess operating levy referendum to just extend what we have. The voters had defeated the previous two referendums. Once we made reductions and shrunk and became more efficient, because we're in a declining enrollment district, the public passed overwhelmingly by almost 60% to 70% to help us out. So if you make government more efficient and smaller and then need some help, you'll find the majority of people in the state of Minnesota will help you. But unlike your gas tax, where you simply bloated government bigger, you didn't shrink it first. That's why the majority of Minnesotans don't support that. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Gruenhagen, it answers it fine. Thank you. Thank you for coming down today.
I'll take questions if anybody has them.
Well, we're going to run out of time for questions, I think.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Scoy... Senator Berglund, Senator Scoy had an issue with the Section 125 plans and the number of employees that an employer had, and we couldn't find in the bill anywhere the word full-time equivalent, so I think it's a little ambiguous whether you could have half part-time employees and half full-time employees. And Council had suggested an oral amendment. Council?
Mr. Chair, on page 49, line 4, insert full-time equivalent.
Senator Berglund, does that live within the intent of the language?
Yes.
Senator Larson moves the council's oral amendment. Any discussion, members? All in favor of Senator Larson's oral amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Berglund, there's a many of the testifiers talked about the fact that the fees or assessments in here are really just hidden taxes. And I'm wondering, is anybody from the governor's office here? I mean, I've heard that the governor's office supports the bill, and but at the same time, I hear the governor's opposed to tax increases. So I'm wondering what the governor's, I mean, it seems like we heard an awful lot of testimony that they're taxes. Just wondering. Anybody from the governor's office here? Senator Bergen, to your understanding, does the governor support the bill?
Yes.
Senator Moore, what's
Mr.
the difference?
Mr. Chairman, if I can just do the best I can here. The savings offset assessment does not come into play unless there are savings. So the cost of health insurance is coming down before any assessment is imposed. So the way that we look at it is it's reinvesting part of the savings that we would otherwise be enjoying. In terms of the hospital and not-for-profit assessment, again, they are required under federal law to reinvest in their communities. We would consider this assessment to meet that obligation. In regard to the assessment that would be imposed by the health insurance exchange on the small group product, it would be only as much as is needed to operate the exchange. It is a way for them to pay for being able to enjoy this 125 benefit, which in the future has the possibility of bringing, you know, $300 million of federal money into our state to help make insurance more affordable.
Senator Moy, you used to have a little fun fact that from Webster's Dictionary, I think it gave us definitions of what's a fee, what's a surcharge, what's an assessment, what's a tax. They all seem to be about the same. You well, still have that little fun fact in your folder?
You know, Mr. Chair, I was looking for it, and I think it got taken out, but I'm going to go get a copy of it, and I'll get it around to all the members. But I seem to recall that a tax is a fee charged to the public, and a fee is a charge for a specific kind of service, and a surcharge is an extra fee for that service. So I think it's all the same, Mr. Chair.
Maybe we should add assessment to your list.
Oh,
I don't know what Webster thinks an assessment is.
I will do that before I pass
Senator
it.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to go back to what Senator Berglund just said. Mr. Chair, last year we passed the Demand Efficiency Act, which was a dramatic change to our goals in the conservation improvement program that the utilities are charged with carrying out. And you know, the rates that utility payers pay can be thought of, in a sense, as taxes because, you know, these are monopolies to deliver those services. And, you know, you don't really have a choice but to pay your light bill. And so that's, in a sense, a tax. And what we asked the utilities to do last year is to do whatever it takes to save 1.5% in their energy savings rather than what we had done previously, which was to simply ask them to spend a certain amount of money. So conceivably, the utility companies are going to spend more money to save more energy. However, there is a cost-benefit test that has to be applied. So everyone has to save more money than the utilities will be spending. And so everyone actually ends up saving money, even though the utilities get to recover some of the costs from their ratepayers. So the ratepayers, you know, are helping with the effort, but the ratepayers are actually going to be spending less because we're not going to be bringing a bunch of baseload online. People are going to be saving directly on their utility bills from efficiency improvements to their use of energy and the like. And so Senator Berglund's bill seems like a very similar concept. If there's no savings, there's no cost. Just like with the Efficiency Act, if there's no savings to everyone, there's no cost.
Senator Rosen, before we move the bill out, would you like to have a – I think you're an author on the bill, so.
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Berglund's done a very good job. I had a bill this morning up. That's why I was not able to give her moral support on this. But I think Senator Dibble made a very good analogy about this, and I'm not sure if Senator Berglund mentioned what our health care costs in this state will be in the year 2015. They will be – projected to be $54.7 billion. If we continue on the path of our spending from 2000 to 2005, we continue on until 2015, $54.7 billion. So this is, we're at a crisis level, Mr. Chair and committee members, and we have to do something. And this is an agreement that came about and worked very hard on all, on the Legislative Commission and the Transformation Commission and the Governor's Office. And we can debate assessments, fees, and taxes, whatever you want to say, but this is an agreement that was made to move this reform forward. And this reform is necessary right now. It's going to be years of work, but it's a good piece of legislation that I think we should move forward with.
Senator Rosen, this committee spends a lot of time on what surcharges are and what fees are, and it just, I think the opinion of this committee is if a fee is not optional, then it's a tax. And I don't think we should be kidding ourselves. This is, and I think for a very good purpose, but I think we at least ought to be honest with everybody that that's what we're doing. Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rosen, you mentioned that there's an agreement. How many elected officials were in on that agreement, or is this a composite of business people, whatever motive they have in making that agreement? Please explain to me who makes the agreement, and why are we obligated to support that agreement?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Rosen.
Senator Lemmer, you are not obligated to support this agreement, but this has been the work from the Legislative Commission on Health Care over the summer, and that was all legislators that worked here every week on this topic, and it was from the Governor's Transformation Health Care Task Force, and there was four legislators on that, along with 13 other members from the private business sector that dealt specifically with health care, an extremely stellar, brilliant group of people, and the governor's office. So this is a chance to make true reform that, yes, it's not all perfect. Actually, the Transformation Healthcare Task Force came out with the recommendation of a tobacco tax increase that I supported, because I supported the last one 2 years ago. And I think we could make it more even with what Wisconsin and Iowa is doing. But the point is, everybody comes up to the table and says, oh, this is a great piece of reform, but... Well, the buts, we do have to move forward, and I do appreciate what this tax committee has to do, has to address all these issues, whether it's assessment or tax or.
Well, members, I think the one thing that bothers me a little bit, and Dr. Wilson came up and said the revenue's been unable to put a number on what the tax expenditure in this bill is relative to those 125 plans. That's a little concerning, I think. So at some point in time when we get down the road, we're going to ask them if they can a little closer define what this reform is actually going to cost the general fund in the area of a tax expenditure. I think it would be helpful. If we don't know that today, I think it would be helpful for us to get our arms around that. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, and just to reiterate that thought, the one testifier that was just very, I like his analogy on that. This is going to be the administration costs. We have no clue because it could grow and grow and grow. It's like that light rail thing, or you know, although we can't nail down the operating costs on this thing.
Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Berglund, when this bill came before us in Judiciary, I raised a question about the board itself, the makeup of the board, and the question I had, and it wasn't in the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee. I understand this bill went to GovOps, and there was a question of whether or not the members of this board will be subject to open meeting law, or will it be under an open appointment process rules that the state has. Was that addressed in GovOps committee?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lemmer, I'm assuming you're talking about the board for the exchange?
That's right.
Yes, the open meetings law does apply. We don't have it in the bill. We don't need it in the bill. Any appointments that are made by the governor that are not exempted from that requirement, the requirement does apply.
All right. And then the open appointment process, is that also going to be governing
That's what I just said.
Membership.
It would be open appointments process.
Well, there's an appointment process and there's an open meeting law. right. where members, a majority of members, cannot have discussion on policy without having a formal meeting.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, the exchange is structured to be a not-for-profit corporation, so government open meeting laws would not apply to it, but we have no problem, and I'd be happy to work with you in terms of making sure that they would have open meetings.
Right.
I think that's probably a reasonable suggestion. Senator Pogelmar moves that Senate file 3099, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Rules. Any discussion, members?
We get a shot at it.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Contrary, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Members, we're going to put off till tomorrow Senator Dibble's Bill 3534 and Senator Clark's Bill 2841. They'll be added to tomorrow's agenda. This committee's adjourned.
Thank you very much.